This podcast involves topics such as violence, sex, and mental illness. If this might disturb you or those around you, please reconsider. It's okay. Privacy and confidentiality have been protected, with personal information removed when possible. If you ever feel unsafe or suicidal, please call your local crisis center, emergency services, or national hotline. In the U.S., the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255. You matter.
Growing up as a latchkey kid in a small town in Maine, I always assumed I was safe. After all, unless it makes national news, murder isn't something people talk about around here. But that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. Murder, She Told is a true crime podcast featuring crime stories, unsolved murders and missing persons, and baffling cold cases from my home state of Maine, New England, and small towns across America. These are the crime stories your hometown doesn't want to talk about, the mysteries buried deep in the newspaper archives of local American history. These are the homicides you've probably never heard of before. Through detailed storytelling and connections with family, friends, and investigators closest to the case, Murder, She Told will hit home for any true crime fan, whether you're from Maine or from away. Visit MurderSheTold.com to suggest your hometown crime story and subscribe now wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'm Kristen Seavey, and this is Murder, She Told.
Hey, this is Kate. You've heard me somewhere between complain and outright rant before about a certain lack of sensitivity that can happen among the true crime genre, whether it's writing or spoken word podcasts or movies or, you know, Netflix, things like that. I just don't like how it's handled as though it's fiction. Probably because I've spent a lot of time working with perpetrators and victims, and I know it's real. I've been a victim. I know it's real. This is not something to drink and giggle about. For me. So it's not to say that I'll never talk to people who work in that genre, in that field, but it is to say that I'm picky, I guess. I'm careful in who I choose because I have a little bit of a platform here. I have people that listen, and I'm going to assume, since you've been sticking with me for 5 years, that you get it. You get where I'm coming from. And so I want to steer you in the direction of creators that get that it's real, and not necessarily steer away from the horror and fear and pain of it all, because that's real too, but they don't laugh at it. And they do their research. They find ways to be sure that they're as accurate as they can be. Like, those are important things to me. So I was delighted when I was chatting. It was one of those Facebook conversations where it just happened that both of us were in the same talk. And I started talking to author E.J. Hammond. She has written a ton of podcast episodes, all of which, when I hear it, I'm like, I bet that's EJ. I like that. Because she just goes this extra mile to learn how to do the research and how to word things in a, I don't want to say sensitive because that sounds mushy. It is sensitive, but it's also not unnecessarily gory or sensationalistic, right? So we were chatting and I was like, you want to come on my show? And she said yes. So here we are. Well, almost 2 months later, here we are, but you get that. And I'll talk a little bit about that after, at the end of the show. Not too long ago, EJ and a co-author, Fabian Richard, released a book about Ted Bundy, but not the Netflix Zac Efron version. And so we talk about that some. We talk about true crime some. And we talk about some projects she's got coming up. And it's all just, well, you'll hear it. Are you sure you really want to know? This is Ignorance Was Bliss.
My name is EJ Hammond. I am a true crime author, podcast, and screenplay writer. I'm fascinated with all things macabre, serial killing, and cemeteries.
And you just, let's not forget to tell people, you just published a book.
Yep.
So you're a published author.
Yes, I am a published author. My book, Ted Bundy, Memories of the Beast, has come out, and it is available on Amazon.
Are you someone who started with the, I've always wanted to write and happened to find a genre that interested you? Or was it the genre that pulled you in first and you decided to write about it so you could kind of learn more about the genre?
It's actually a little bit of both. I knew very early on, because I'd always been a big reader, that I wanted to write. And I began my writing with poetry and fiction. Probably some of the worst poetry you've ever read. As fascinated as I was, I realized that that really wasn't where I wanted to go as far as writing. Once I became interested in the true crime genre, it was a lot easier to imagine writing it. Once I started reading a great deal of it, I realized that this is really what I want to write. I want to be able to share the stories. I want to be able to help families of victims in these crimes. And I also, in an historical way, I wanted to preserve a lot of that information. And I believe that's why getting involved in the Bundy case was so important to me and writing about Ted Bundy, is it is so long ago, at least as of now. And I really wanted to preserve a lot of information that hadn't been made public yet.
Do you get kickback from people who talk about fetishizing true crime or voyeurism, sensationalism, that kind of deal?
I don't get a lot of that. I've been very lucky. And I think it's because I approach the topic with a view towards the victims, the survivors, their families, and putting more of a spotlight on that aspect of crime, as opposed to specifically writing about the killers and glorifying them. That's the last thing I want to do, is to glorify a deviant or a violent individual.
It's a tough one. You know, I'm a forensic psychologist by trade, and I started the podcast because, you know, they kind of say, you know, it's like write what you know, talk about what you know in podcasting. Right. So I was like, all right, well, I'll start a podcast about sort of what forensic psychology is and what it isn't. You know, it's not profiling, but it's not therapy, that kind of deal. And I was at a conference for podcasters, and I had someone gatekeep me, telling me that what I did wasn't true crime enough. And I was like, what? what do you mean, I guess, first? And they were like, well, true crime podcasts are all narrative, and I really want the gory details. And I was like, okay, this conversation is over.
Wow. Yeah, I've never heard anything like that. And I can't imagine that someone would say that you weren't true crime enough. Very strange.
I mean, my answer to them is there are shows out there that are narrative and that are gory and that are, you know, no holds barred. That's all fine. I think part of it was, while I am not an apologist and I don't excuse offenders, I also recognize the humanity of offenders, and their families are sort of secondary victims of their crimes.
Right. Right. Yeah, I can't imagine what the thinking was behind that statement.
I think thinking is a strong word.
Very true.
But why, so for you, why Bundy specifically?
Truly, the reason I think I've bonded so much with that story is it has a lot to do with he was the first serial killer, lust killer I'd read about. And I also realized that my mother looked a lot like his victims in that era, the long, dark hair parted in the middle. So I began to kind of attach to those victims. And my mother looked a lot like Linda Ann Healy as well. She was one of the very first victims that police have acknowledged from January of 74. And just being able to look at her and at the old photographs of my mother at that age, they were very, very close in age too. I think that I immediately became very protective of the women that he killed in an esoteric kind of sense. So there's also so much of his story that hasn't been told, you know, being that it was a longer time ago than we really acknowledge that true crime was interesting. And there's so little information about him out there compared to a lot of the newer criminals. I wanted to go back and research Bundy and get a lot of the detail of his story and put that information out there. We hear so much about him and so many rumors about him that we've been able to dispel through that research. So that's kind of been a goal once I latched onto his story specifically.
And arguably, you know, the story of Bundy sits in a different space than a lot of other known offenders, in the sense that his has been really sanitized, and he's thought of as this really suave guy, and that he sort of did these terrible things and then went back to a normal life. And we've kind of learned otherwise.
Yes, absolutely. He was... a lot of the media wanted him to look like the boy next door, somebody that you would have gone to church with, or you would have met in, you know, your politics, local politics. And the truth is that was very surface with Bundy. He wasn't that person at all. He was very much the dark side of his personality was the true Bundy. And thankfully, we've been able to give a voice to that aspect of his personality and really speak out on behalf of the victims and the survivors of his crimes.
Which I think is super important because, you know, people talk about one reason given for people saying, I want to learn about true crime, which I hate the word true, by the way, it's all just crime.
Yeah.
But one reason why sort of true crime is a genre is that they're like, well, I want to learn more about it so that we can help prevent it. And I'm like, okay. But that means you're going to learn about really heavy, dark stuff. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to like, you know, but I think one of the things with Bundy is that he was part of the original, you know, John Douglas and Burgess and Roy Hazelwood studies on serial killers. When that was a flawed study, but I don't blame them for it being flawed. It's just any study when it's the first of its kind is gonna have flaws. And so they did things like focus on pre-offense behavior more than post-offense, and they don't use words like necrophilia, and they don't use words like pedophilia. And those, if you're really gonna understand it, you gotta understand the whole picture, even the hard stuff.
Absolutely. It is very difficult to read sometimes, very difficult to write. Just realizing the effect of their violent behavior. Specifically, for example, in Bundy's case, you're right. He was a necrophile. He was someone who was a consummate liar and a thief. We also know that he was returning to crime scenes to put makeup on his victims, you know, and these are bodies that are left out in the weather. So who knows what they look like? He did enjoy the process and watching the decomposition of his victims. He liked their skin changing color. He was just a very disturbed individual. And unfortunately, the media gave him this, look that he was just, somebody who got caught up in something or was killing for a certain reason based on his childhood. And they really simplified this disturbing individual, for the public.
And I don't think that there's anything wrong with, I mean, listen, you're literally a forensic psychologist, so like clearly, I don't think there's anything wrong with getting to understand people on a deeper level, but it just feels like so many people want to cherry pick. You know, they don't want to think about like Dahmer is only a cannibal, and Gacy was only the crawl space, and Bundy was only the, you know, sort of political suave Zac Efron type. And it's like, well, it's a tough one.
He never was quite that suave. I think, we have so much time between when he was alive and now that it's easy for us to pretend he was something he wasn't. And of course, he wanted the world once he started using the media to his advantage after he was arrested and charged with murder. He wanted the media to view him as, just the guy next door. So he learned to take the media and make it his own.
I mean, you're certainly a smart guy, for real.
He was smart. I don't know that he was smart enough not to have been caught.
Agreed.
So.
Agreed. And so, I mean, does it go from there? Like, I'm trying to figure out what I'm asking exactly, but is it serial killers? Is that where you feel like your niche is, or is it sort of, look, you know what? Different crimes grab me, and I don't really know why.
It truly is lust killers. When there's murder, and generally organized killers. So they're the more intellectual, more intelligent, organized killers who are fascinated with violence and sex. There's something about that draws me in. So it's not all Bundy. He is, the number one killer that I know the most about and have the biggest connection with. But, again, it's Dahmer, it's Gacy, it's, Samuel Little, Derek Todd Lee, it doesn't matter what their ancestry, their backgrounds. If there's sex and they're an organized killer, then I will probably know something about them.
Do you feel like, I mean, do people, not you in here, I'm trying, I still feel awkward when people are like, are you an expert? Because I'm like, literally could barely find my socks most days. But like, do you feel like you know your shit
I do, yes.
through you, did you go to school for learning about criminology and or in crimey stuff, or is it more self-taught?
It's self-taught. I have a bachelor's degree in Spanish language. So very different from what I'm actually doing now, but I always wanted to write and I came back around to it after college. So were I to be able to go back and change my major, I would have changed it to criminal justice and probably minored in writing, something along those lines.
Which I want to be super, super clear about the fact that I think academic qualifications are overrated. You know, like legitimately, there are friends of mine who have never attended a day of college who are better at reading other human beings or understanding the motivations of other human beings in the way that theoretically a psychologist, say, would be able to do. It's just that I had to pursue a specific route of schooling to get the job that I wanted.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're right. You don't have to have gone to college to be intelligent. Not at all. I find that a lot of intelligent people without college tend to be big readers.
With less student debt, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
Absolutely.
there is that. Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. So I have a master's in criminal justice in that was interesting. That was sort of a way station because I started as an engineering student. Oh, wow. Only because I desperately wanted to move away from home. And I found an engineering school that had a program that let me skip my senior year of high school. So that's 100% why I went that route. And then I realized, I don't like this. Don't like this at all. Right. And so I switched to, so I graduated with a psych minor, my major. I was literally the only psych major in my engineering class that year.
Yeah.
and so I got a criminal justice master's before I went on because I was like, I think I know what I want to do, but I want to confirm. And very early on, I realized like criminal justice wasn't quite it for me. And it was the most fascinating situation because in the classroom, it was exactly two groups of people. On one side of the room, it was a bunch of like 21-year-olds, and they were cute, and they were, you know, just, they still had hope, and it was lovely, and they were going to change the world. And on the other side of the room, it was cops who had been cops for like 5,000 years, and they had figured out that they had to get a master's degree if they wanted to climb the ranks.
Ah, yes.
Mm-hmm. And so it was like thunderstorms in the middle of each classroom.
I'll bet.
You know? And I remember being like, I'm not really either of these. Like I didn't go in with much hope. And I certainly didn't have the experience that the cops did. But I remember thinking of the number of the younger they were kids. They're still kids to me. I have a 22-year-old, so I'm allowed to call them that now. But even at the time, I thought of them as kids. Where I'm like, you don't know shit about shit. Like you just don't. And these cops may have gotten, you know, an associate's degree 35 years ago, but they got stories. They know stuff.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
So it's wild. It's, you know, I feel like there's something about the U.S. specifically that really weighs on, you know, like you have to go to school to learn things. And I'm like, half of schools, their whole job, they seem to feel, is to make you stop thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. Or you have to take mindless classes that don't teach you anything for the real world.
And I mean, like, I guarantee my husband's sitting upstairs right now glaring at me and he doesn't know why, because my husband is an educator. But if you want to go the academic route, fine. But it's more that, like, I ask because I'm curious. Like, some of the best writers I know are the ones who didn't go to school for it because they're not writing how they've been told to write. They're not thinking how they've been told to think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think I learned so much from reading growing up that I'm able to jump between different styles of writing and, you know, recognize when something needs to be edited or corrected. So really just being a lifelong reader has helped me with my writing.
I know that you have written for other podcasts as well as writing for yourself. Is there a difference there for you in the process between writing sort of on commission or for someone else as opposed to writing your own book?
With Bundy, I don't have to do a lot of research. I've read so much on him that it's all in my brain. More or less. There may be something that I need to go back and look up just to verify, or I need a date. And I've got a veritable library of references for him. But as far as writing for someone else, I'm sometimes writing about Bundy or an aspect of his life. But several of the podcast scripts I've written have been about different killers. So the writing process for that involves a lot more research, finding a certain angle at which to present the information. So there's more research. There's a certain style of writing that's different in a podcast script than something I might write for myself or my blog. And so it's really kind of learning the way that the podcasters already have scripted their podcasts in the past. You want to make sure you're matching their style. And of course, just being able to get the information and make it as accurate as possible. One of the scripts I wrote was about a 19th century female killer, and there was very limited information on her. So we had to use a little bit of imagination just to kind of flesh out that script. But either way, it's always fascinating to me and exciting to jump into a new topic or a new style. because every time I do that, I'm learning something new.
Before I ever, I don't know if people know this, before I ever started my own show, I wrote for another podcast, and it's no longer in existence, which is kind of sad. Like, I would have at least downloaded it or something before. But, you know, it is what it is, and pod fade happens, and that's fine. But you ticked on something for me about the finding the tone, is that this particular podcaster had a very, I don't, not necessarily unique, but stylized way of speaking. And I had to get out of my own head to be able to write. And I only wrote a couple of episodes because I decided that, like, look, if I'm going to put this much work into it, I'm going to make my own show, because I'm kind of a pain in the ass that way, but that's fine. that's just how I roll. But absolutely, that's a skill. So it's not that I want you to, you know, give away jobs, but if somebody comes up to you and says, I want to write for podcasts too, do you have advice, or do you tell them, oh no, it's not possible, I don't know what you're talking about?
No, I don't mind sharing that information. I feel like the more we help others, you know, the better it makes the industry as a whole. So yeah, if somebody were to ask me for advice on something like that, I would at first try and find out what they're writing. You know, is it true crime or is it something else? You know, and just make sure they understand, go and listen to the podcast in the past, you know, so you understand the way the hosts interact, and, you know, if it's two or more hosts, or the way that the, let's say one host is able to narrate the story, and just be able to kind of find that tone, as you say, and, you know, try and write to the best of your ability for that particular host.
And I mean, I hope this is true for most other writers, because otherwise I'm an idiot and I don't want to be an idiot. But early on, you kind of got to do some work for free.
Yes.
Like, there's got to be proof of concept, and it works to a point where you can start charging for your research and your writing and your time. But early on, you kind of got to be like, all right, that's what I'm doing this week.
You do. You do have to start out with, in fact, when I wrote the third season of the Criminology podcast, that's the podcast that's hosted by Mike Morford and Mike Ferguson. That was something that I had 3 months to write 22,000 words. And if you've written before, you know that is not a lot of time to write a whole lot. So luckily I had some information on my blog I could kind of pull from. And, you know, but it was grueling, but at the same time, I learned a lot. And that was definitely something very early that I got to write. So for me, I benefited a great deal, even though it wasn't a paid job. Plus, you know, it gets your name out there. It's more people talking about you, and, you know, you can add that to your CV and just kind of, you know, get yourself saturated in the market. So the more you do for free a little bit further on, then you can go ahead and charge. And I have had some paid jobs as well. And then, of course, with my book coming out, of course, I get paid for that as also. So the more you put out there, you realize that people start coming to you when they want your assistance. And at that point, then you can arrange for a fee.
Is there anything that you flat out would not write?
I have a hard time with connecting with crime fiction. There are some fiction books that are really good, and I wish that I could write that way, but it's hard for me to get beyond the beginning and the middle of a fiction story. So I would have difficulty writing that. I don't really enjoy romance either, so I wouldn't write for the romance genre.
You're more of a nonfiction girl.
Yes. Yes, very much so.
I just right there with you. Like, I my brain doesn't think right for fiction, so I even have a hard time reading fiction sometimes. But I definitely, I can edit someone's fiction work if they want help with that. But even then, I'm just like, I can do the spelling and the grammar, but, like, I'm not your girl for moving the story along. Like, it looks good. Two thumbs up. Good. Thank you.
Right. Same. Same thing.
And where do you find information?
As far as what we wrote with the book, so I already had the backbone of Ted Bundy, his information, and we were able to reach out to a lot of subjects, people that were involved in the Bundy saga, the Bundy world, some of the survivors, really found some of them on Facebook, other people, my co-author had already made contact. When I'm researching a story, I'm usually online unless I've got a book, for example, about it. I may go to Amazon and download a book if that's the case, if I need more information. But usually it's online or it's in a book that I'm researching specifically.
I'm dabbling with the idea, and it's sort of like it's gone from it's a sure thing to But still, it's not off the table yet of coming up with a narrative true crime of a story that happened in Washington State in 1977. And there's nothing out there. There's absolutely, like when I say nothing, I mean there's like a total of 6 inches of newspaper column over multiple articles, and that's it. And so my friend and erstwhile co-host, although he has had to back out because it just doesn't fit in the world he wants to write in. But he did the FOIA request. And so for people who are not familiar, FOIA is Freedom of Information Act. And that's sort of, you write a letter to the local courthouse and you say, hey, can you give me all your stuff, please? And they can do that. They can say yes and send it to you, or they can tell you no. And if they tell you no, then that's where that's sort of a brick wall there that you have to figure out either a way around or a way through or whatever. But in our case, they said yes. And it's gotta be 8 or 10 inches high of paper when it's all printed out.
Oh, wow.
Like it's so, because it's the original police reports, like the sketches of the scene that the officers did on the day of, and I'm looking at all this, like, how do I turn this into a podcast? And my answer right now has been to get totally overwhelmed and put it away and not turn it into a podcast. So, maybe don't use me as a role model, but I don't think people realize like even that, one of the reasons that I'm struggling with that a little bit is that all of the information that I have there is from, yes, it's primary source, but it's one source. It's one angle. And that's the police and criminal justice angle. And that's hard. Like, to me, I would rather find more information out there. And so that's what I'm coming to you and telling you to fix my problem. But seriously, like, it's hard.
Have you reached out to anyone that's been named in those files? Any family members or friends?
The family has not responded, but they also, they just said they didn't want anything to do with it. They didn't say don't do it. So that's
good.
I found a list of involved officers. And so I may start to go through that.
Yeah.
It's weird. Like, I don't know journalism. I don't know all that. You know, the whole concept of cold calling people is terribly overwhelming to me, but that has to be done.
That can be difficult. A lot of the people that I was able to interact with, I either reached out to them on Facebook, because a lot of older people, if there's any social media they'll be on, it's probably Facebook. And then once I got my contacts there, I actually was able to connect with a couple other people through the people I initially met. So they recommended I reach out. So you should reach out to so-and-so. This person, doesn't mind being interviewed, or they'll tell you, tell them that I mentioned reaching out to them. And it's interesting how much name dropping can help you. There were a couple people for my book that I, wasn't sure if they would be involved. And these were people in an official capacity. And because they understood that I was reaching out on behalf of a couple of the people that were involved in the case, they were willing to talk to me because of that.
It's dominoes.
It is. It really is. And that was so helpful because one of the individuals I not only got for the book, but I got for an article on my blog. So that was really helpful.
So cycling back around to Bundy specifically, are there things that you learned that were a shock to you, or is it more just filling in the blanks for you?
Meaning reference to?
Things that you learned about Bundy himself or the case.
There have been a lot of things that I learned about Bundy that were not the same as the rumors that have been put out for a long time. For example, there was the concept that when Bundy went to Florida, this was the end of his crime spree. I'd always been told that when he entered the sorority house on Florida State's campus, this was in 1978, that the door that he entered through, the lock was broken. That was the recurring statement. That's how he got in that night. I actually asked the sheriff that was working the crime scene if that had been confirmed, expecting him fully to say, yes, that's the case. The lock was broken. And he said that was not confirmed. So there's no real information about whether the lock was broken, whether he somehow broke it, whether the door just wasn't locked. But I was really startled when he said not confirmed. And that's exactly how he phrased it, not confirmed. So something like that, that had been accepted as true a long time ago, was now called into question. And unfortunately, there's not a way to know one way or the other at this time. I'm sure that door was replaced long ago. And then just, you know, just other little details have just been fascinating. Something I had not realized was the witness that night, who later came to state that she did see Bundy in the house. I don't know how she could have identified him, because the person that came in the house had a hat on and she only saw him in profile and it was dark. Just the fact that he had been confused for the houseboy, who was, I don't think he lived at the house, but he came in to help with some of the chores that I guess men typically held in those days, like fixing things. Apparently there was confusion whether or not it could have been him, and he was several inches shorter than Bundy. So just bringing that into focus was interesting to me, because when I talked to another one of the survivors, she, you know, immediately knew who I was talking about, but she hadn't been aware that he had been suspected for a very short time of being the intruder. So things like that, things that just are very small details, really are important to me when we're telling that story.
I think with any story, like, that's what brings the story into 3D.
Mm-hmm, yes.
I was going to say into life, but that's a little too on the nose, you know.
Yeah.
But it, you know, but it brings it into focus. Like, it creates real life. And
yes,
there's a difference between, you know, a newspaper article often is just the facts, ma'am, kind of
right
approach. But if you're going to write a podcast episode, or definitely if you're going to write a book, you got to flesh it out. And it's those little details, you know, that's for me, I tend to, once in a while, I'll get on a kick of, I want to learn everything I can about some given topic.
Yes.
Whether it's a crime topic or not, I'll listen to four different podcasts on the same thing. And learning one little thing, just learn something where I'm like, I didn't know that. And I love when that happens, that moment when you have like the, you know, the neuron lights up for a second and you're like, oh, I learned a thing. That's amazing. And I always hope to sort of be able to do that for other people out in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Especially if you want to, if you want to preserve the information. And as someone who's just fascinated by history, it's so important for me to get the answers right. I want to be, plus it adds a lot to my credibility. I don't want people to look at me and question whether the information is correct. I want them to know I worked and I found that information. I went right to the source in some cases. You know, or I was able to locate information in the court filings or in some of the court video. It's just so important to be accurate.
Have you had people outright challenge you? Like, no, I know better. You're wrong about this.
Yes, I have.
How's that?
I've had people, particularly on my blog, because I think it's easier for people to confront you online than it is in person.
Keyboard warriors, yep.
Yeah, exactly. Just about different facts about his life that I was able to go back in and provide evidence of. In one case, it was whether or not Ted's professor, I'm sorry, Ted's uncle, Jack Cowell, had been the piano teacher for a little girl named Anne Marie Burr who went missing from Ted's neighborhood when he was 14 and she was 8. And yeah, I had somebody very rudely post on my blog about that's not accurate, yada yada, and I was able to back that up based on just a Google search, you know. But I'd also read that information by other historians. And so that was one of the reasons that Bundy may or may not have killed her. You know, the on the pro side of that argument was the statement that, well, he knew who she was for sure because his uncle was her piano teacher.
Do you think he did?
Do I think he killed her? I think it's possible. I don't know if it's probable for a 14-year-old to get away with that kind of crime. Her body's never been found. And so I don't know. It's possible if maybe an adult was involved as well. But yeah, unfortunately, I don't know if she'll ever be found, and I don't know if anyone will ever be charged with that crime. So it's very hard to say.
Yeah, and that was early 70s, right? So that's
It was 1961.
so early 60s even. I'm off by a full decade. Yeah, see, and that's exactly that's one of those, I was just listening very recently to a show that started talking about the Black Dahlia case, which I'm in Massachusetts, and so Elizabeth Short is from Medford,
Where she was
Mass.
from.
Yep. And so like I've worked in the neighborhood that her family is from before, because I used to do in-home crisis assessments once in a while. And so yeah, I know, like I they talk about like this street and I'm like, I know exactly where that is, you know? And I again, I like listening to hear like, oh, I didn't know this, or I didn't know that, or what, or whatever. But then the second half of the podcast that I was listening to, they started getting into the supposition and guessing about who done it. And I'm like, it was 80 years ago almost. Like, okay. Like, I don't even know what. Let's just, there's so many other places we could put our time and I, of course we want it solved. Like, realistically, for her, for her family, for anybody impacted, of course we would like it solved, but realistically, like they in that case they definitely found the body, and we still don't have any idea really.
Unfortunately, some, you know, at some point it's probably not going to be solved, and that's something that you just have to accept.
And it's a hard, we don't, humans don't like, I don't know.
No, we don't. That uncertainty.
And so, do you know what next for you? If you answer me and say I'm writing a book about the Black Dahlia, I'm gonna feel terrible. But what do you know what's next for you?
I'm not doing that. I recently just finished writing a movie script for a serial killer film. I'm working with actor Bishop Stevens and director Ash Hamilton. We're putting together a movie. This is not about Bundy. It's about a different killer. Unfortunately, I'm not able to give a lot of information yet until that is publicly revealed, but I'm really excited about that. I've got another interview coming up with Andrew Dodge for the Unforbidden Truth podcast. And I'm working on a documentary with another crime content creator about a different serial killer. So I'm still within my genre. It's just not all Bundy all the time.
Sure, but and even if it was, like, frankly, being the expert on a thing, there's nothing wrong with that. But it sounds like you're getting to sort of move around within the space.
Yes, absolutely. And I just spoke with my co-author with whom I wrote the first Bundy book, and we are actually looking at a second book a little further on, and it's going to be based on the victims and the family of the victims. So I'm excited about that too.
So, if that's the second Bundy book, talk to me about the one that's out.
Absolutely. The first book that my co-author Fabian Richard and I have put out is called Ted Bundy Memories of the Beast. The concept was to talk to people who were touched in some way by Bundy and his actions. And we wanted each individual to take a photograph of that era that reminds them of that time in their lives. We've got two of the survivors from the Florida Chi Omega attack who were involved. We've got one of the neighbors of another Florida victim who saved her neighbor's life. We have a journalist that interviewed him, several people involved in the police department, two of the attorneys that prosecuted Bundy, and one of the sheriffs at that time in Tallahassee that took custody of Ted, among other people in the book. And it's really just a reframing of the Bundy story. We wanted to talk to people to determine not only how they survived or how they got through that era, but how they were doing on the other side of the Bundy attack, the Bundy, their interaction with him. And I really think first of all, we've gotten a really good feedback about the book. So we're getting really good information back from the people who are reading them, not only them, but the people that whose stories weren't included in the book are really enjoying not just seeing their story being told, but also the other stories that are included. So far it's really doing well. We're very excited to have changed the narrative in the story of Ted Bundy and really focused on the people that surrounded that story instead of it being all about him and being that same story we've all heard about Bundy and his life. So I'm really excited, and I can't wait to get to work on the next book.
You get what I'm saying, right? That it's fine. Look, it's fine if you want to giggle and drink while you talk about true crime. If that makes it more palatable to you, knock yourself out. It's just not for me. I'm not going to listen or read or partake. It even irritates me if I come across crime in a fictional setting that is not handled delicately or accurately or, reflecting the actual misery of it all, I guess. Like, yeah, I get we've got a lot of misery in the world, but go ahead and do your research. I'm thinking of a specific book right now, and I'm not going to name the author, but it's somebody pretty well known. And I thought, oh, I've enjoyed other books by this person. I will read this book. And I ended up within, I don't know, a day or two returning it because I was like, this is their pretend idea of how a serial killer operates. And I don't need that. I don't want them to be censored. I don't want anyone's book to be burned. Don't ban books. Don't do that. It's just not for me. I spent too much time in school. I've been trained very well to know how it works. So, EJ, thank you so much for coming to talk with me and for seeing the horrors of the world but through a lens of hope and awareness that there are survivors and that they matter too, and there are sort of adjacent victims to things and they matter. Like, oh, that's really, really important. And so thank you for the work that you do. And I very much hope that you'll come back on when your second book comes out. Thank you guys for listening. I'm getting there. I'm still pretty sick. We're still working on finding a treatment that works pretty well. And it's iffy. It's touch and go. But my next episode, which will come out probably Thursday or Friday, depending on my health and that kind of deal, is with another person who has the same diagnosis that I do. He happens to live maybe 5 miles away from me, which is wild because it's a really rare disorder. And, you know, I keep backing away from really explaining what it is that I'm going through because there is that sense of, hey, don't I get a little privacy? And I do. I opted for that. But then I also know that I have a platform and a voice here, and let's use it. So it's a very frank discussion of what are your symptoms? How did you get diagnosed? And what are you doing to get through the days now? And it's really, really personal for both of us. And I hope you listen because our stories matter. Your stories matter. I just don't know them all yet, but I can tell you right now that I'm going through it, and it's just important to not shy away. I think, like, you deserve your privacy if that's your priority. But I mean, obviously, I don't much care about privacy. And so it's important that I not shy away from sharing with you. Here's the thing that I am going through. And it's been a lot, like a lot, a lot. So that'll be my next episode coming up shortly. In the meantime, please take good care of you. And remember that I mean it when I say it, that if you have a story, and you do, you all have a story, you don't have to tell it. It's yours to do with as you see fit, but it's worth telling. You matter.